Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of THINK. I'm Chris Boyd. Does divorce have to be ugly, destructive, and expensive? The end of a marriage is nearly always a sad upheaval in partners' lives, and in traditional divorce proceedings, the relationship deteriorates even further as husband and wife and their attorneys battle it out in court over possessions, payments, and child custody. But a growing number of professionals are steering their clients toward a more collaborative approach in which the divorcing couple try one final time to work together to divide their assets and obligations. Joining us today to answer your questions about how it works are certified financial planner Scott Clark, licensed professional counselor Linda Solomon, and attorney Curtis Harrison, who is a managing partner of the law firm Albin, Harrison & Roach. Welcome all of you to THINK.
Well, thank you for having us.
People have said this before, collaborative divorce sounds like an oxymoron. You have these people who've decided they can't live together, they're fighting over everything. How does it work that people come together and make the divorce happen in a, if not amicable way, at least workable way?
Well, I think, first of all, most of the people that we work with, or in my experience that I work with, have one primary interest first and foremost, and that is that they want to do what's best for their children. Despite whatever's going on in their marital relationship, they have a commitment to have the children do well and thrive as much as possible post-divorce. Based on that, that seems to be a huge motivator for many of them to look for an approach other than divorce, other than litigation, which tends to often push them further apart as parents.
So how does the team work together? It's an interesting assembly we have here. It makes sense if you think about it, but this is not the way it normally happens.
You know, it's really not. I think, you know, as we've discovered here in Texas, it's a kind of a model that's evolving. You know, over the last 10 years since Collaborative came to Texas, you know, it did start off from just an attorneys-only type of model. But then slowly but surely, you know, the mental health professional was integrated into it and the financial professional. And I think it's one of those things where you begin to take a look at as benefits are being added, as you discover what the different professions bring to the table. We've just learned that a team kind of working in the same direction for the clients, it truly is the most effective outcomes as possible with them. So I'm not sure what y'all's thoughts are.
Well, I would add simply that people have, over time, have come to realize that the courthouse was never designed to resolve their family law matters. Courts were designed to handle criminal disputes, civil breaches of contract, personal injury, those types of things. It's designed to create a winner and a loser. People that are going through a divorce have already experienced inordinate loss, and they've come to the realization that the courthouse doesn't offer them long-term solutions. And so once they've done their research, a lot of folks are coming to the realization that they can bring alongside themselves some experts in respective fields of mental health, financial, perhaps there's a business valuation that needs to take place, and they take control over not only the outcome of their own divorce process, but the process itself. They take that control out of the hands of the courtroom, and they put it in the hands of their specially trained attorneys and the neutrals.
I also want to give credit to the many family law attorneys who were instrumental in the beginning of the creation of collaborative work, because many of them recognize that divorce is not just a legal process. Certainly, divorce is here because of a relationship that's struggling and ending. So there's psychological issues, there's financial issues, there's spiritual issues, emotional, legal, etc. And early on, so many family law attorneys recognized that and said, if we are going to offer a very good product or service to clients who are going through this difficult time in their life, let's look for other professionals who have experience and expertise in these areas. So as a team, we can offer the package to these families to help them in as many ways do as well as possible post-divorce.
Yeah, I would imagine, Curtis, when you don't have people like Linda and Scott in a team, are you serving those roles anyway? Are you the de facto financial planner and counselor?
We do a very poor job of it, yes. Absolutely. When we don't have the full team, the attorneys and the spouses themselves are definitely at somewhat of a disadvantage. However, with attorneys who are essentially pulling on the same side of the rope, we can try to approximate some of the elements that the full team brings to the table. It is but a mere shadow of the expertise that Linda and Scott and other professionals of their background and training bring to the table. But for the process has to be scalable. And in cases where we're dealing with families who may not be able to afford the full team model, we may have to do the best we can to approximate that.
So each partner gets his or her own attorney, but you two are classified as neutral. So you work for both. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. When I'm working with the clients, I'm there for the benefit of both of them. I'm there working with them from a perspective of how can I help them both reach an acceptable financial agreement. So as I work with them and work with the attorneys, it's kind of in that light. How can I help them both through that process?
In my training, I'm a marriage and family therapist, so my training taught me over the years to look at the entire family system and think about if mom is doing something, how's that impacting dad? How's that impacting the children, grandmas, grandpas, aunts, and uncles? So transitioning into this role as a neutral, my job is there, as is Scott's, to think about the entire family. Right, and so it was an easy transition from training in marriage and family work.
What does it take for you both, and I understand that you're both professionals, to keep the individual partners from trying to make sure that you see things their way specifically and know that mm-hmm. the other person is just lying and what a jerk? How does that work?
Ladies first.
great question. Depends on how much time you have. First of all, I think I'll speak for myself. That what it takes is the recognition and reminding myself that I'm there to think about both of them all the time. And my job is not to lean toward one or the other. My job is to remember when I'm talking to mom that I'm hearing mom's perception of what's occurring, her reality. When I'm talking to dad, I'm hearing his perception. And often, as we know, in the midst of stress and divorce, the truth lies somewhere in between. So my job is always, if I spend time with mom, to spend equal time with dad and to be sure I'm asking questions and spending time with both so I remain impartial.
And I think in terms of, I 100% agree with everything Linda just said. And from my perspective, because financials can get fairly emotional and working with couples, but I always think in terms of, number one, just talking to the clients about what the benefit to both of them about having a neutral is. And even though they may try to slant you early on unintentionally or intentionally, but as a neutral, the benefit is helping them both. And if they realize that, I think you're less likely to get kind of that trying to skew it to one side or the other if they recognize the benefit of working with you in that light.
Is there any way to have a couple divorce and not have each of them walk away poorer than they were collectively?
Can I ask you, when you say poor, can you maybe define that a little bit?
With fewer resources than they might have had. I understand that they're paying now two mortgages or rents, but is there? You always hear about people really taking a financial hit on both sides in a divorce.
Yeah, I think just because of the way the economics are, I think number one, I think it's almost impossible not to happen because you're essentially taking things and dividing them.
Sure.
So you're naturally going to have less money. But I do think in terms of it's possible for couples to be more secure financially post-divorce. There is a potential for, as a financial player in the process, to coach people and guide people about proactive steps that they can take in their post-divorce life. Is it possible for you to be able to take a look at and go, you know what, this would be a great time to downsize, or this would be a great time to maybe take a look at other career opportunities? And if you do these things, you can have a secure financial future. So I find so much in couples when they're financially, it's often the blame game during the marriage. He did this, I did this, you did this, he did this. One of the advantages, probably one of the few financially, is there's none of that post-divorce. It's you, it's my financials. I mean, it's that individual responsibility. If you can coach people and work with people in such a way that they can have that because it's them and it's them managing themselves. And that's the one positive aspect I love working with people on. So
Curtis, how does your job change when you are advocating for a specific client, but you have this team of neutral people looking out for each party's interest?
Wow, that is a loaded question. And it's what we call a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. As attorneys, as litigators, we're trained to go out and be gladiators, to go out and to do battle for our clients, either in the courtroom or across the negotiating table. The type of negotiation that we're trained to do is called positional negotiation. I win, you lose, and anything I have to give up in order for you to get something in exchange for that cost me or my client something.
Yeah.
It requires an attorney to make a mental choice, to step away from that model, to lay down the gladiator's armor, and to put on what we call our settlement specialist hat. And we talk to our clients about it in advance, because collaborative law, as great as it is, and I'm definitely a proponent of it, it's not for everyone. And a client needs to be able to make an informed choice that this is the way that he or she wants to go. Assuming they make that choice, then my responsibility to that client is to advocate from a position of looking out for the interest of my client, not necessarily the position.
And am I correct that typically the arrangement is that if either partner decides to go to court after all, that the original attorneys quit?
It's one of the linchpins that makes the collaborative law model function. Excuse me. In order for the attorneys to stay vested in the process, at least on paper, one of the things that is written into the participation agreement that the parties and the attorneys sign requires all of the professionals in the case to withdraw in the event one or both of the parties decides, you know what, I want to go to court, I want to have my day in front of the judge or jury.
I'm curious, Linda, about the couples who come in and you're working there as a counselor with them. I suppose they've been to the point that they've decided that they can't work out the marriage. What does it take for you to avoid, when you sit down with them, going back over things that at this moment are no longer germane?
One of the things it takes is just the recognition that initially, on a practical basis, I sign and they sign a participation agreement. And that agreement lists what my role is and what it's not. And my role is not to work with them as a therapist, which means I would most likely be doing a lot of past history, mm-hmm. a lot of family of origin work, a lot of detail about their marriage. That is not my role. My role here is primarily to look forward and help them look at what they need to be able to honor and deal with whatever emotions they need to deal with in regard to their marriage, but at the same time, put those aside so they can create a positive, healthy co-parenting relationship going forward.
Did they ever come back to you after the papers are signed and ask for additional help?
Yes, that's a great question, Chris. Often, one of the beauties of the collaborative process is it offers them the option to come back to me in the same role only as a neutral, mm-hmm. to work with them together on any co-parenting concerns they might have post-divorce for many years to come. And typically that's built into divorce decrees and they have that choice. I think it's a great benefit because I've worked with them throughout the mm-hmm. divorce, learned about their children, learned about them. I have the history of what's going on. So it makes it much easier.
Yeah, I would imagine there are things that no one anticipated being an issue coming up 5 years down the road that suddenly present this roadblock.
Well, I think that's always true. None of us have a crystal ball. One of my favorite sayings, we just don't have a crystal ball. But particularly with couples who have young children, we can anticipate there will be many changes that will occur in each adult's life, and therefore many changes with the children. No matter how much time we spend talking about a good, solid plan for co-parenting, life shows up, things change, and things happen. And I think couples appreciate knowing they can step back in through my door if need be to talk about those changes in a safe setting.
We're talking this hour about collaborative divorce with licensed professional counselor Linda Solomon, attorney Curtis Harrison, and certified financial planner Scott Clark.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guests this hour are attorney Curtis Harrison, licensed professional counselor Linda Solomon, and certified financial planner Scott Clark. Scott, what sorts of financial records do people have to lay on the table, and how often is there a very large surprise, even among people who have been married up until just a couple of months before they came to see you?
Well, From the first question about the records, the standard ones that you have in any divorce are just a part of the process. So anything that they have to provide in litigation would also be providing collaborative. So there's no the clarity's there from the financial documentation. Plus, the other thing I'd add on is also any other information that either one of the clients wants or their attorneys once in order to help them make informed decisions down the road. So there could be more or less than the standard depending on the situation. Now, as far as the second question, it could come in two frames. So I'll answer the first one. Generally, in a couple of my experience, even in financial planning clients that I'm working with, generally there is a division of responsibilities on who does what in the financial family. Sometimes one person handles the investments while the one person handles the kind of the day-to-day things and or vice versa. But generally, there's some regard. So there's lack of knowledge on both sides, either the bill paying or the assets. So as far as surprises, sometimes it's just communication of the information, meaning making sure that people understand what is there, what's not there, what the bills are, what aren't they. So, but as far as big picture surprises, like, oh, we totally forgot about that, I had no idea, that doesn't occur all that often, frankly. Usually there's some awareness of what's going on in the collaborative process.
Which couples are a good candidate for this, and what makes it which differences are so irreconcilable that you turn people away and send them to a traditional set of professionals?
Well, I'll just share a couple of thoughts, and then I'm curious, Curtis and Scott, what you might have to say about that. One of the things that I often say when you're sitting on an airplane and people ask about collaborative, and they'll ask that question, and my answer typically is folks who have the emotional maturity on board to want to step aside from their marital emotions and create a new and different and more positive relationship going forward to help their children. That's number one. Number two, folks that have the ability to recognize they have lots and lots of emotions going on, but they have the ability, whether a therapist on board, a good support system, their own sense of it, to know how to put those emotions aside at times and move into their logical self and make good business decisions about the rest of their lives. Thirdly, folks who have a willingness to truly collaborate. We use that word a lot, but it means we sit down together, we gather information, we explore options, we brainstorm together, we look at goals that each one of us have for the future, and all of us collectively talk about what might we create in terms of the children and financial settlement that could honor these goals. Folks who truly are able and willing to do that.
I'm curious about when you talk about the best interest of the children. I have to imagine no one getting a divorce says, I don't want what's best for my kids. But people at this point probably have very different ideas of what that means.
Yes. I would say almost across the board, that's the first thing I hear from parents. I'm curious, Curtis, that I would assume is true for you often.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. Parents, almost without exception, will articulate that they want what's in the best interest of the children. You know, therein lies the problem. How do you define that? Mm-hmm. And what I've experienced over the years is that parents will almost invariably substitute judgment for the child. And because of the situation that they're in, the stress that they're under, the problems that they're dealing with, very oftentimes their parental ability to perceive is impaired. They don't really see, cannot really see what is truly in their children's best interest.
Mm-hmm. And so part of honoring best interest of the children and really working with them on that goal, because they all do set that goal, is checking with them to be sure that they have the willingness and ability to truly look at the impact of their words and actions on the children. And I work with them, as do other mental health professionals do this work, to develop a filter. And I often call that filter, is that husband and wife talking or is that mom and dad talking? Right, and to really try to learn which side of their brain they're speaking from, and I put that word in quotes, of course, but which side they're speaking from, and to learn how to deal with one another as parents as opposed to spouses. That takes a while, and it takes a commitment. But the children need them to do that. They need them to do that. In my opinion, that's best interest of the children. So,
and I was going to talk about the initial question. I'll tell you, as a collaborative movement, we spent a lot of time early on, you know, who is right for the collaborative process? What clients can we work on? And frankly, we try to come up with checklists. We try to, you know, can we flow chart this out on who's right? And we really couldn't do that because it's kind of hard to sometimes put a finger on ultimately, you know, who's going to fit in the collaborative process. Mm-hmm. But I think most people begin to look at it through the lens more so. People, we're becoming number one as the teams become stronger, as we become more familiar with how we can work as a team to help clients, willing to take on more and more different types of people and some of the stuff they bring to the table. So I think a lot of our lenses now are, you know, this may be a very challenging couple and collaborative, but if they were in a different resolution methodology, what would that look like for them? So I think we're really stepping out there more and more often and willing to take on those challenging cases because of that lens that we're applying to that. So,
and I've seen something very similar to that. And the way I look at it is, do you want a process that by its very nature, by its design, is intended to bring out the worst in people? Or would you rather have a process that at least affords the parties an opportunity to lay all that baggage aside or to unpack it during the process so that you can deal with it and move forward? The collaborative process by design is forward looking.
Is it easier to get home and not need like a double scotch right after work when you work in these circumstances than in the standard?
Well, I'll just simply say that whether I'm dealing with a litigation case or a collaborative case, a family law case is a family law case. When you see a family in crisis, you see children in turmoil. It really, for me on a personal level, it helps me to really appreciate who I have and what I have at home.
And I would agree with that in my own life, and I'll add another piece to that. Prior to doing this work, I always say I spent 18 years behind a closed door as a therapist, hour after hour with 10-minute breaks, and wasn't allowed, nor would I, talk with anyone else about what I did all day long.
Mm-hmm.
And would go home
because
at night exhausted. Mm-hmm. One of the unexpected gifts of this work is I now work with three other professionals all day long with whom I can brainstorm and do need to brainstorm all the time about what can we do to help this couple? What's our next step? What do we suggest would be the next way to do this? It's a tremendous benefit for me professionally to be able to work with three other professionals. And an interesting challenge because they think differently. Lawyers and financial professionals, I'm generalizing, mm-hmm. are trained to look at a problem differently often than those in my profession.
Sure.
So I like the challenge of that. It's been great for me, and I didn't expect that. It's something I hadn't really thought about before we started this work.
Yeah, I was going to say probably the financial professionals, it's a little bit different frame for us because whether we're financial planners or CPAs, generally we don't live in the world of divorce. So for me, it's a little bit different. In other words, I don't get to compare and contrast between litigation. I'm comparing against my regular financial planning clients in divorce. So I'll tell you, it does. There's rewards in it that are very much expected, but there's also sometimes you go, wow, this is really challenging, and it gives you a greater appreciation for things outside of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Mark in Dallas. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
Hi, Mark. Go ahead, please.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Thanks.
Good show. I had a question. I'm in the process of a divorce. Have not completed a settlement agreement yet. Got married in the early 50s. My wife and I both been married about 3 years, kept most of our property and assets and things separate over the course of the last 3 years. Gone through some pretty challenging times, and it's created necessity for us to get divorced. And when I say a necessity, it's more, I guess, an emotional necessity than anything. But the question I have, I've been self-employed for 15 years with a company I own, and in the last year and a half, it's been really, really a tough market, tough business, and I have, over the last year and a half, probably obtained support or assistance from my wife in the tune of about probably $40,000 to $50,000.
Let me stop you right there, Mark, because I want to make sure that we're not asking anybody to sort of practice what they do over the phone because they haven't met you. But maybe we can. Is that enough information for you all to talk about how something, a situation like that, might be handled in a collaborative law situation?
Well, just speaking in the most general sense, not really knowing exactly what the issues are, it sounds like the caller would have an opportunity through the collaborative model to to come in either with a full team or at least with the mental health professional and the attorneys and discuss about discuss options. One option would be to talk about how to divide the assets and the liabilities that have been accumulated over the course of the marriage. I inferred from what the caller was saying that we're talking about a second marriage. And another alternative might be to use the collaborative process to discuss the potential for a postmarital agreement. If the goal is to try to preserve the marriage and yet there are some financial considerations and financial concerns, the collaborative model is ripe for discussing those types of issues and coming up with creative solutions that doesn't necessarily lead to a divorce decree.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Clifford in Allen. Hi, Clifford.
Hi, I appreciate your show. I got a custody question for the lawyer, Mr. Alvinson.
It's Mr. Harrison.
Mr. Harrison, I'm sorry about that. My wife and I, we're going through looking at divorce right now. We got custody issues. And is there a plan? I think it's called a 30-30 or a 10-22 or 30-06 or something. It's a custody plan where we help. We both have the kids and a shared. And I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
Thanks for your call. And once again, we want to talk today specifically about collaborative law. And so we want to make sure that we're not simply answering. It's not a legal advice show specifically, but there are lots of different options in terms of the way you can structure time together.
One of the great things about the collaborative model, if you contrast it with the traditional litigated model, I look at it as the law provides the curbs on the road. The parties are traveling down that road, headed from where they are to where they're saying they want to be, which presumably is a divorce decree or some sort of an order affecting the parent-child relationship. And the law provides those curbs, but the law is also limited by those curbs. A judge or a jury really can't deviate beyond those curbs. And so in the collaborative model, we wipe away those curbs. And the parties are limited essentially only by their collective creativity, the creativity of the professional team that they bring alongside them to come up with solutions that will benefit themselves and benefit their children both now and in the future.
So there's nothing in the law to say if both partners agree to a certain situation that provided it's safe for the kids, there's nothing to say that any arrangement isn't acceptable.
The judge in a typical divorce case has an independent duty to make an evaluation about the best interests of the children. Mm-hmm. But it's been my experience that unless the agreements that the parties enter into violates public policy or violates the Texas Penal Code, the judge is not going to bust the deal. So it really is up to the parties and the team that they have that's serving alongside them to come up with those solutions, and then the judge is going to honor that.
Scott, I'm going to assume that you don't ever have cause to meet with the children, but is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, but do you, Linda?
That's a great question. Typically, I do not. I spend my time focusing on mom and dad, but we're very focused on the needs of the children, and it is common that we have an additional person spend time with the children, and we often refer to that person as having the voice of the children. Just this morning, I spent time on a matter where the therapist who's been working with the children and myself talked with mom and dad together, talking about a parenting plan, what might work, what might not. She brings the voice of the children, and I've worked with the parents, and it's a great combination at that point. So
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time, speak with Ray in Arlington. Hi, Ray.
Hello. Listen, on the talk, I'm hearing primarily a lot about kids, and these are probably some short-term marriages. I don't know, but I wonder what the average is of your services for long-term marriages, 30 years plus, kids are grown, there's property acquired, the divorce is, one-sided, but, after a couple years, they're ready to start moving forward. So I was wondering what the average, marriage length is for your services.
Let's get an answer for you. Thanks for your call.
I don't know if I could give you an average, but I'm handling cases currently where we're dealing with spouses who've been married over 40 years, and we're dealing with significant size estates. Any children that might be involved are already grown and have children of their own. The collaborative model is broad-based enough to encompass both, you know, newlyweds and those who have been married for 40 to 50 mm-hmm. years.
Same is true for me, sir. I worked on one matter. They'd been married less than a year, and they had a baby 3 weeks old. And I've worked on a number of divorce matters in which there are either, A, no children at all, or, B, the children are long grown and out of the house, and so forth. I think the recognition we have is that children, no children, whatever the situation is, ages, there's one common factor in any divorce: emotions. And therefore, we look at having a team present to help folks go through that.
And the only thing I'd add on to that is the socioeconomics are also extremely diverse and collaborative. I think we all can think of cases where very, very wealthy individuals, but I've also worked on cases where very, very challenging financial situation. And so even with a diverse kind of, as they were talking about age, there's also diverse socioeconomics, and all of them are appropriate for collaborative and a team working with them. So.
And I would simply add to that as well that it's an interesting point. We've been focusing and are focusing our conversation on how collaborative law applies in divorce and family law context. But collaborative law is appropriate in sexual harassment cases, breaches of contract, personal injury cases, and it's in construction litigation. It's being used successfully across the board in the civil arena.
Mm-hmm. We are talking this hour about collaborative law with three participants in this week's Collaborative Law Institute of Texas Spring Conference. We have Scott Clark, who's a certified financial planner, Linda Solomon, licensed professional counselor, and attorney Curtis Harrison with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are an attorney, a licensed professional counselor, and a certified financial planner, Curtis Harrison, Linda Solomon, and Scott Clark. If you want to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. So lest people think that everybody who comes in for collaborative law probably could have worked this out over the kitchen table on their own and might be getting along fairly well anyway, you all three deal with people who, at least in that moment, really hate each other.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. To one degree or another. And it is important to communicate that collaborative law is, it's not therapy. It's not counseling. We're not brought into this to try to resolve all the issues that the parties have. What we're doing, though, by design, is we're taking the conflict out of the courtroom and we're putting it in the privacy of a conference room, and we're dealing with those issues in a safe environment, a controlled environment, where the parties themselves dictate the outcome, mm-hmm. as opposed to abdicating that responsibility and that right to a perfect stranger in a black robe, or even better, 12 perfect strangers with driver's licenses.
Sure. So I want to back up for a moment, if I may, Chris, to your question or your comment about folks who really hate each other. And I just have a little bit of a different perspective on that. That has not been my experience. Mm-hmm. I will say, though, that my experience has been that it's folks who either have lost some or all of respect for one another. They've lost some sense of liking one another, maybe not loving, maybe that's lost also, but some sense of liking. The mm-hmm. friendship is damaged in the marriage, and or they've lost some, if not all, trust, right? And when you put those combinations of things together, it's very difficult to attempt to make decisions about your children and your finances, because those things are so important to people. And part of our job is to help give them little tools, bit by bit by bit, to recreate some sense of trust, if possible, to start to rebuild little by little, and or at least not to sever their relationship anymore, which, as I mentioned earlier, often happens, I believe, in litigation. So
I was just going to say, yeah, I think emotions are definitely a part of each one. To yes. Linda and Curtis's point, those emotions show up in different ways. Sometimes very strongly in kind of the, I think how you phrased it, but there's other ways that it does show up. And it would be almost impossible for any of us, even the most stoic people that we see, you know, when you see them on the surface, they're lacking emotion. It's there, and it mm-hmm. shows up in collaborative as well as any other frame, I'm sure.
Scott, do you jump in on things, you know, where you're dividing not simply who gets the 401k or whatever, but, you know, that big screen TV that was bought last year? Are you down to that level of minutia?
Yeah, well, Linda and I are laughing at each other because usually I point it in her direction. it's an ongoing joke. But no, I think part of one of the things that the financial person does, and I do when I'm initially meeting with the clients, is having those discussions with them on options on how they can handle it. And what we find, if people are coached and if people are given options on how to handle it, and you say, here are the tools, I'm finding in probably 9 out of 10 situations, people actually, with what we call the stuff, and I don't mean to minimize the stuff, but the stuff, the couches, the TVs, if you give them the systems and you give them the cost benefit of doing it on their own, people actually go out and execute. Mm-hmm. And it's a way that actually begin to do some of the thing Linda was just talking about, how they can maybe divide up some of that stuff and build some of that trust or work together in that framework. And but if need be, you know, we're all, I think any of us would be, I mean, for that couple that 1 out of 10, we're happy to help if that's what's needed. We just point out that there's a cost benefit for us doing that. Versus them working out on their own.
Linda, is it not really about the couch?
You read my mind perfectly, Chris, because I was listening to what you said, Scott, and I totally agree in our experience. But when we have those couples that are not able to divide up who gets which couch, or we often teasingly say the frequent flyer miles, it's not about that. It's about emotions. It's about all kinds of things. Sometimes it's the very last piece of a divorce settlement to be determined. And you may have the spouse who's still deeply grieving, and he or she is not yet ready for this divorce to be final. And sometimes it's an unconscious way, isn't it, to still stay married and hang on while you're in your grieving process. I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready to sign a document that says, I know I'm getting there, but I'm just not there. So often, and this is the beauty of teamwork, the team will talk. And often when it's that type of thing, they'll ask me to step in and talk with them about the couches, the miles, the paintings, whatever it might be, the chairs, et cetera, because it is often about emotion.
Does this process work in relationships where one person, for whatever reason, whether it's sort of social or financial, had more power within the relationship than the other person?
Well, I don't know who wants to go first. I guess I'll take a stab at it. I have no background in mental health training. I'm an armchair psychologist just by virtue of being a lawyer, I suppose.
You should get some stripes for that, though, I think.
I would give a qualified answer to that question, and I would say that the collaborative law is able to handle cases in which there is a power imbalance. It's not appropriate for every case because there are different types of power imbalances. Mm-hmm. There are different causes for it. In some ways, the collaborative process is the great leveler, because one of the fundamental principles you've already touched on, the attorneys and the team have to withdraw. Another principle underlying the collaborative process is transparency. And transparency can take many forms, but, you know, exchanging financial documents, talking about elephants in the room, which may be very uncomfortable for parties to do, it tends to level that playing field. There are other types of power imbalances that might tend to undermine the collaborative practice or collaborative process. And for those, I think I'd turn it back over to Linda.
Yes, there are many different types of power imbalances. I agree with what Curtis has said. And I think in this setting, it would be difficult to go into that in great detail. But I will say the good news is the more experienced we become as teams, and I give much credit to the family law attorneys in our area and actually all over the world who are practicing this, the more experienced they become and other team members in terms of intake and screening potential clients, the more and more a lot of that information is able to be determined up front. Is this person appropriate? Are they not for collaborative? Often the family lawyers may call the mental health professionals in the area who are trained collaboratively and run a hypothetical scenario by us to talk about, might this be appropriate for collaborative or possibly not. Lastly, that you've mentioned a couple of times on this program that we have our state conference coming up this week. This is where we come together as professionals once a year. All three professions come together and we spend 2.5 days studying how to better ourselves as teams, how to better ourselves in terms of assessing clients who come into the process, assessing their needs as we go along, how do we help them? That's really what the rest of this week is focused on for our conference.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to Peter in Fort Worth. Hi, Peter.
Hello, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a practicing lawyer, primarily engaged in family law for the last 33 years. I just got out of it. But you just talked a lot about the concern and the comment that I would have about this, and that is that, you know, I've watched the practice of law go from straight litigation into more collaborative process, and certainly I've had lots of successes. But often that power sharing or the imbalance in power really can derail that process. And I've had many clients who have gone through that process and later on felt remorseful, as if they had been kind of bullied into things. And in connection with that, I really have a concern that the courts are tending to shirk their responsibility to actually make hard decisions in many instances by pushing very hard to get litigants to kind of give up the battle and go into this kind of setting. And for many people it works, but I've seen other instances, especially from my prior years in practice, where you see judges make those decisions and do it efficiently. And I worry that that is kind of being thrown out the window, along with the idea that everybody has to come to an agreement on their own.
Well,
and
Peter,
that's my comment. Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much. Let's get a response for you.
I'll take a first swing at it. Peter, thanks again for the call. That has not been my experience at all when it comes to collaborative law, and I'll simply respond by saying that, number one, collaborative law is a completely voluntary process. The court does not have the jurisdictional power to compel or persuade people to go into the collaborative model. So to the extent that there is any power imbalance, I wouldn't see it coming from the courts. There is an indirect benefit to the courts by folks opting into the collaborative model, because I think most jurists, at least the ones that I've spoken with, would tell you that the court system is backlogged and overloaded, and they're simply not able to handle the volume of domestic litigation cases that are out there. I would also like to note that Texas was actually the first state in the union to adopt a collaborative statute that gives the parties the legal right to opt into this process. And by doing so, they actually strip the courts of the legal authority to do anything in their case for so long as they remain in the collaborative process. And either party can opt out at any point. It is a voluntary process from start to finish. To the extent that there are power imbalances, those same power imbalances are going to exist in litigation. Again, it comes back to the question, what type of process do you as a participant want? Do you want a process that is going to, by its nature, bring out the worst in your spouse? Or would you prefer another option, another alternative that you and your spouse can voluntarily enter into that in most cases tends to level the playing field? And the other cases that we're talking about are what I would describe as the fringe cases, cases where you're dealing with power imbalances because of mental health issues, which I'm not qualified or equipped to talk about.
Well, the other thing, of course, we don't know the folks who have given those comments to Peter about feeling bullied or whatever, but what popped into my mind as I listened to him was I found myself wondering if the professionals with whom those folks worked had been appropriately trained. We spend a lot of time going through a series of trainings, and it's based on interest-based negotiations, to be sure that we offer clients safety and an appropriate method to work out decisions. And we're very conscious, all of us, about being trained and continuing to train others. The other thought that came to my mind as I listened to him, again, sad to hear some folks felt bullied, but one of the kind of sayings we use in this process is, there are no agreements until both of you are comfortable saying yes or both of you say no. There are no agreements. We'll roll up our sleeves. We'll keep working. We'll keep looking for what's important, what your concerns are. Let's keep exploring ideas until both of you are comfortable with yes or comfortable with no. We all have responsibilities to the clients to be sure there's a tremendous comfort level with their yes or their no.
And I just think, even stepping back, I agree 100% with what both Curtis and Linda said. And if you just step back, at least from my perspective, it, to me, it's the beauty of the team to help in the collaborative matter. If you think about getting divorced, there's the legal aspect, there's the emotion / parenting plan, and then there's a financial aspect. And you have team members that are there to support the clients through those decisions. So if it's a financial, you have a financial neutral. If there's a legal question, you have your attorney who's an advocate. If there's a parenting plan question, you've got an expert in MHP who's so familiar with the parenting plan. So if someone feels, quote unquote, weak in an area, which is creating the power imbalance, you have people there to help level that and to make it that safe and secure environment for people to make decisions. And how great is that?
We're running out of time here. We have a couple quick emails. Michelle in Wiley wants to know the comparison in cost and length of time the process takes of collaborative divorce as opposed to traditional divorce.
We can only talk in generalities because every case is different. I would never promote collaborative law to a prospective client of mine as being a cheap divorce. It's not intended to be cheap. It's intended to offer an emotional savings for the parties. It may very well wind up being less expensive financially than litigation. But again, it's very difficult to talk in terms of specifics because most litigated cases wind up settling short of a contested final trial. So you wind up spending whatever money you spend in a litigated case right up, it could be right up until you get to the courthouse steps and then you settle your case. Some others go all the way to a contested final trial. Collaborative cases can resolve in as few as one meeting, where we all get together in one conference room for a 2 or 3 hour period and the parties are both comfortable resolving the case. Well, that's going to be a very inexpensive, from a financial perspective, divorce. Other collaborative cases may need 4 or 5 meetings depending upon the complexity of the issues, whether we're talking about the child's needs, the financial issues, or business valuation. So, it's difficult to say, but there's definitely an emotional savings in those cases.
My guests this hour have been Curtis Harrison, attorney and managing partner of Albin Harrison Roach, Linda Solomon, licensed professional counselor, and Scott Clark, certified financial planner. All three will participate this week in the Collaborative Law Institute of Texas Spring Conference. Thank you all so much for being here.
You're welcome.
Hey,
thank you
very
for having
much.
Us.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.